Thank you. Be seated. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Burroughs Welcome Company versus Robert M. Cry, independent executor of the estate of Jewel K. Cry from El Paso County. And E. I. DuPont, the New Morrison Company, Incorporated versus C. R. and Shirley Robinson from Parker County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. The court will take a very brief recess in between the presentation of the two arguments, and then we'll adjourn for the day. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court, and if you desire to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear from petitioner in Burroughs Welcome versus Cry.
May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Alley and I represent Burroughs Welcome. This products liability lawsuit raises two issues for the court's consideration. First is whether the trial court erred in submitting an out-of-court experiment that purports to measure the difference in the cooling effect of five aerosol sprays on dead pig's feet, when in fact the issue in the lawsuit was whether polysporin spray, an over-the-counter antibiotic, can cause frostbite in a live human being. The second issue for the court's consideration is whether the El Paso Court of Appeals discharges its constitutional duty to review the sufficiency, the factual sufficiency of the evidence to support an award for intangible damages by, in effect, applying the no evidence standard of review. Because Burroughs Welcome sees that there has been error in both of these areas, it seeks relief before this court. In 1993, the Carnegie Commission on Science and Technology, after doing a review of science in America's courtrooms, reached the conclusion that there are severe criticisms in the way that judges and juries handle science-rich cases. The fear of the Carnegie Commission was that for America's most important legal questions, we are turning over our courtrooms to paid mercenaries who bring to the court science for hire. Now, this case here is not going to be able to solve all the problems that we have with science in the courtroom. But this case does present this court with an opportunity to clarify what really is existing Texas law to put some restraint on the admissibility of out-of-court experiments. The standard for admission of science, and obviously our comments are directed only towards out-of-court experiments, because that's what this case deals with, comes really from two sources. First, Rule 702 permits scientific opinion testimony if it is helpful to the trier of fact. This fits hand in glove with Rule 401 and 402, which permits relevant evidence to be admitted. Evidence not relevant is not admissible. And from these rules, you can really discern two criteria for the admission of out-of-court scientific experiments. The first is the test or the experiment must be relevant to the theory of the case being presented to the jury. That is, there must be a fit between the test or the experiment and the hypothesis that that test or experiment is seeking to validate, and the hypothesis of the case or the issue before the jury. The second criteria or test for admissibility is, of course, the test must be scientific. But turning to the first test, is there a fit between the out-of-court experiment and the hypothesis that it is testing and the theory of the plaintiff's case? Texas has, in effect, already said, there are a number of courts that have said for an out-of-court experiment to be admissible, it must be substantially similar, or reasonably similar, to what happened or the issue that's before the trier of fact. And so, in effect, I'm not asking this court to change Texas law. I'm just merely asking this court to apply Texas law, existing Texas law, to this particular case.
Wasn't this introduced on the theory that there was a design defect?
Well, design defect was in the case.
And the plaintiff was not successful in
it. Ultimately, that's correct. Ultimately, the design defect is not here before this court. But the test, obviously, is used, and the results of the test are used for the warning issue and the warranty issue and the negligence issue, which are in this court. The real scientific issue in this case, the one that required some expert testimony, was whether polysporin spray could cause frostbite in a human subject. To use the scientific vernacular, that is the hypothesis of the plaintiff's case. The hypothesis of this scientific experiment was much different. It took five different products, applied it to dead tissue to measure whether there was a difference between the cooling effect of one spray as opposed to another spray.
Well, is there any other evidence in the record of the causal connection?
There is sharply conflicting evidence as to whether Ms. Cry suffered any frostbite at all. The testimony was that she had a long history of diabetes that was largely uncontrolled. She had open sores on her feet, which are portal ways for entries for infection. That at some point, I believe in 1987, she felt the need to go to the store to buy this product. That she applied it and then went to go see Dr. Herman, who is board certified, trained at the Mayo Clinic, practiced in Canada where frostbite is not unheard of, and he diagnosed an infection and treated her several weeks with an infection. And then she goes to see Dr. Blesius. Dr. Blesius says that assuming that there was no infection going on, I think that there was frostbite in this case. And then later, Dr. Ratner, who opened the diabetes clinic at George Washington University, came in to review this, said that this is not frostbite, this is infection. So there was sharply conflicting evidence on the issue of whether there was frostbite in the first place. But the reason why this test was so significant was, under the guise of testing whether there is a difference in the cooling effect of five different products, Professor Fuentes makes the statement that application of polysporin spray on the surface of the dead pig's foot created a 77 degree temperature drop. And the fallacy of that, first of all, he did that by saying there was a 25 degree Celsius decrease, and then he translated it to 77 degrees Fahrenheit. In candor, he later admits that it was something more in the order of 40 degrees Fahrenheit. But the fallacy of this is Dr. Fuentes is applying the spray for 1 inch, 1 inch away from the metal thermocouple, and he does it for 5 seconds, which is not what Ms. Cry testified she did. She testified that she followed the directions on the can, which would have put the can 8 inches away using 1 second intermittent sprays.
Mr. Alley, the Court of Appeals concludes that even if it was erroneous to admit the pig feet study, it was harmless error. How is this harmful?
Well, for some of the reasons I've already elucidated, we had a lot of sharply conflicting evidence on whether there was frostbite here at all. The only quantitative link that Ms. Cry can add to her causation argument comes from the Fuentes study. In other words, their argument is an aerosol product causes cooling. Cooling, if it gets beneath freezing, can cause frostbite. How then do you get from cooling to beneath freezing? The only way to do that is this quantitative measure that the Fuentes study adds, a 77 degree drop.
Are you contending that the opinion testimony would not by itself support the verdict and judgment?
From a, well, yes, we brought a no evidence point of review. But
so you're saying that just a physician's opinion that frostbite occurred in this case would not support the judgment by itself?
A physician's opinion who says, assuming fact A, my opinion is there's frostbite. If there's no evidence of fact A, then the opinion has to fall. I mean,
so you're not arguing a broader proposition, which I guess we may get to in the next case, which is that opinion testimony by itself cannot support a judgment. You're arguing that since the basis for this opinion has not been shown to exist, that therefore this particular opinion will not support the judgment, but you're not arguing a broader proposition, are you?
Well, we brought several points of error. One attack that said that there was no evidence to support the finding that there was frostbite here. The court didn't grant the writ on that particular error, so I guess I do need to step back and say that the opinion testimony of Dr. Fuentes is inadmissible.
How about her treating physician?
Whether his testimony was admissible? The testimony may well be admissible, but you still could, but he has to lay out certain predicates for it, and if there's no evidence of one of those predicates, and in fact the converse is proven here, then I would argue that his testimony amounts to no evidence.
But assuming the factual predicates or basis of his testimony, there is some evidence of that, would you agree that the opinion that there was in fact frostbite here would support a judgment?
If there were some predicate for that, it would get past a no evidence
and
point of view.
That would be even if Dr. Fuentes had not performed his experiment.
That's correct.
Mr. Alley, I guess I'm a little bit confused because I could not tell from either the briefs and even the Court of Appeals opinion what the basis for the finding that the polysporin caused the frostbite. Let's assume that she had frostbite, and let's assume the doctor says she has frostbite. The only thing the Court of Appeals relied on is some sort of testimony that there was a cooling effect of an aerosol spray. It seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, is it disputed or undisputed that the skin must freeze to have frostbite?
There are two ways to get frostbite. There is trench foot.
Do you consider that frostbite?
That is a vehicle to get frostbite, but it requires the foot to be wet and in a boot for 40 some odd days. The other way to get frostbite is application of a temperature that is sub-freezing,
so
32 degrees Fahrenheit.
What is it about Ms. Pryor's foot that the doctor said it was frostbite? Was it trench foot or was it frostbite?
No, the testimony is undisputed. This is not a trench foot type of frostbite.
That's what I'm asking. So the testimony is based upon this foot freezing.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, the Court of Appeals makes no reference to freezing temperatures in its opinion. And I can't tell from the brief that anybody makes any reference to freezing temperatures in the opinion. What testimony is before the trial court and before the jury in this case that polysporin spray, the whole can sprayed all at the same time, produces the time of freezing necessary to produce frostbite?
There's not.
Now, what testimony before the trial court is there that a woman suffering diabetes and sores on her foot reduces the amount of time necessary for freezing temperatures to be applied to the foot to produce frostbite?
There's not. The theory behind someone with a diabetic...
What testimony is there of how much Freon fluorofluorocarbons it would require to be sprayed on a part of the skin to produce a freezing temperature of sufficient length to create frostbite?
There isn't any.
Then why are we, why do you say it's important for this court to determine that element A of the doctor's testimony didn't exist for there to be no evidence that polysporin was the result? I mean, why is it critical to your point that she didn't have frostbite in order to win on a case of no evidence in this case?
I think you're correct, Judge Enoch. There in fact are two no evidence challenges that are made. There are multiple no evidence challenges. One goes to the fact of whether there was frostbite. Another goes as to whether this product, which has been on the market since 1960, and there has never been another reported case of frostbite, whether that product caused this condition at all.
My question really goes to the point, do we have to even address the issue of the reliability of this scientific evidence before the trial court on the testing on the dead pig's feet to come to the conclusion of no evidence on the causation of polysporin causing freezing temperatures that produce frostbite in feet?
I do not believe so. This court can decide this issue based on the no evidence challenges on just the liability and causation issues and dispose of the case in that way. And those points were brought, but again, the points that the court granted the writ on that we've come today are the evidentiary issues. So if those are germane, I'll continue to address those. But I do believe the court can address the entire case on the no evidence points.
Be sure I understand your answer to Judge Corner's question. Your position is if there is evidence of the hypothesis of the treating physician's opinion, then there is evidence to support a judgment in this case, or not?
Just from the one no evidence point, the one question of frostbite, then...
No, I'm talking about the judgment.
But looking at the case broader, you're correct, Judge Corn is correct, that there are other multiple bases, causation, for instance, that there's no evidence to support.
I'm just asking. I'm not trying to be correct. I just want to know, is it your position that if there is evidence of the hypothesis of the treating physician's opinion, then there is evidence to support the judgment in this case? And I gather from your answer that
you mean no.
All right.
Still, even if we assume that there's frostbite, there's a whole other question, which is there evidence of causation? Would this product there's 4 million cans of this stuff that have floated around and no one else has ever had a problem with frostbite.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
That helps me refine perhaps my question, and that is, in other words, is your position that a bare opinion by an expert will not support the causal connection, the evidence of causal connection that the plaintiff needs in order to have judgment rendered in her favor?
I guess if the bare opinion went to it was broader.
No experiment, no nothing, except the witness qualifies as an expert and says, I swear that this can of polysporin caused frostbite on this woman's foot. Will that support a judgment by itself?
If the opinion was stated that way and there was an adequate foundation for it, then perhaps yes, but that's not, that Dr. Valicius does not make that broad a statement.
Right.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Joel Fry. I represent the respondent, Robert Incry. If I could, Your Honors, let me address what I perceive as an evidentiary no evidence point in this case. There is substantial evidence of a causal connection between the use of this polysporin spray and the thermal injury suffered by Mrs. Cry of apart from Dr. Fuentes' study. Mr. Cry testified, and Mrs. Cry by deposition testified, that immediately following her use of this spray, she suffered an injury which was unique to her condition. She had been a diabetic for years, and had had diabetic ulcers and infections on her feet. But immediately following the use of the spray, she developed a problem which was unique. Her treating physician for over 9 years, Dr. Glesias, when he came back to town and first saw the foot, immediately diagnosed frostbite.
What evidence is there of foreseeability that the defendant should have foreseen that its product could cause this injury? What specific evidence?
Your Honor, in this case, the evidence basically is tied into our marketing defect theory, which was affirmed by the jury in the trial court, which involved the labeling on this product. The product used Freon as a propellant. That was subsequently changed. But the initial label of this product advised the consumer that you could utilize the product, the can itself, in either an upright or an inverted condition. Burroughs Wellcome's own marketing director testified that that label was changed in part because if the can was held in an inverted position, excess propellant, excess Freon, came out of the can and was applied to the consumer. That change was made prior
to... But that's one thing to say excess Freon. Is there any evidence that that excess Freon could cause frostbite or that the defendant should have foreseen that the excess excess Freon could cause frostbite?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, that evidence was elicited from Dr. Ratner, who was the petitioner's expert, an expert on diabetes, where we had a number of questions concerning diabetics, whether or not their circulatory problems would lead them to a thermal injury in using this type of product, if they were more likely to sustain a thermal injury. He agreed that they were. He also acknowledged in his testimony that the Freon, the propellant, was the cooling agent in this product, and it would have a more dramatic effect on a consumer with a diabetic condition.
But that still doesn't get you to frostbite. The fact that it's cold, and the fact that somebody's more susceptible to cold, doesn't mean that the cold caused a frostbite, or that even a frostbite existed.
Your Honor, I think part of the problem is that the doctors use frostbite not as a specific allegation of the type of injury. She had a thermal injury, which caused other problems, which led to a spread of the infection.
So you're not claiming she had frostbite, you're just claiming her foot got too cool or cooler than it...
We are claiming that the cooling effect caused a problem which, in combination with her other pre-existing problems, which were acknowledged, her diabetic condition, her foot ulcerations, which she was actually spraying this product on, that those all led to a chain of circumstances, and Dr. Glesias testified to this, which was initiated by the use of the polysporin spray and required her hospitalization for 48 days. In addition, the medical records, which were brought forth before the Court of Appeals, every doctor that treated Mrs. Cry during her 48-day stay at the hospital confirmed the frostbite/thermal injury diagnosis. In this case, we're looking at some buzzwords, frostbite, pig's feet, which make it seem like an unusual case. It's not an unusual case. We had a consumer with a pre-existing condition that utilized a product that contained a propellant, which was connected to her thermal injury and the problems arising from that thermal injury.
It's the connection that's the problem. As I understand the petitioner's position, it's that there is no evidence of that connection. Sure, Freon is cold. Sure, diabetics are sensitive to thermal changes more than other people. What's the connection between this product and this injury?
Your Honor, in fact, courts and this court as well have found in cases that the mere history of use of the product, if the injury arises immediately from the use, can be sufficient evidence to establish a causal connection.
That strikes me as kind of a res ipsa case, that you say, well, her foot was fine, we put the spray on it, and now it's not fine, and it has to have been the propellant in the spray.
It's not res ipsa, that is a factor, and it is evidence that subsequent to the use of the spray, she had an immediate onset of a unique problem which she had never had in the history of her diabetic condition. That is one piece of evidence. Coupled with the testimony of her treating physician for over 9 years, who had seen her with ulcerations, who had seen her with other diabetic conditions on her foot, and he said this is a unique presentation, this is a frostbite injury.
So you say that the a change in the condition of her foot after she used polysporin is in and of itself some evidence that will support the judgment.
Given the history of use of the product and the immediate onset, that is some evidence. And then coupled with the medical testimony of the treating physician and every doctor that saw her at the hospital, there is sufficient evidence to support a causal connection between the use of this product. I do not believe it's unreasonable to allow a jury to infer that Freon, which is a well-known propellant, if used with an improper label, which allows excess amounts of the Freon to come in contact with the consumer's foot, could cause a thermal injury.
Why isn't it highly improper to have that image? I mean, how would a juror know what it would or wouldn't?
Your Honor, I believe that that is in the general realm of knowledge, that Freon has severe cooling properties. But we're not relying on that. That is an inference that I believe a jury could reasonably draw, given the testimony of Burroughs' marketing director, that we changed this label in part because if you invert the can, you have excess amount of Freon.
Okay, Mr. Pry, yes, if that's the theory, that the improper label was because of the excess amount, wouldn't your evidence, as you put it, have to indicate that Freon in the regular amount would not cause this injury, but Freon in the excess amount would? If you're relying on simply the existence of an injury, and simply the only thing I know of that I did different is I used this spray, and simply a label that failed to say hold the can upright when you're spraying, and therefore allowed an excess of Freon, wouldn't you have to have some evidence before the jury that Freon at its regular level would not have caused this injury, but Freon at an excess level would have caused this injury? And I preface this from the point that it's undisputed that no one has ever suffered a thermal injury from this, at least as far as any of the evidence indicates.
Well, except for the bill of review which we made, that it has caused frostbite injuries on infants when it's been used on the umbilical cord, which was not admitted by the trial judge. It was not before the jury, but that's
so
true.
The record before us indicates out of 4 million uses of this product, no one has reported that particular problem. And you're saying it's a labeling problem, so there has to be some property of Freon when it's in excess that would produce this injury, other than simply you have just a unique circumstance that occurred that was not foreseeable. What evidence, do you agree that if this is the problem in the labeling, that that's the element of proof you must provide?
I believe that is an element, and I believe that Dr. Rappin, who was the petitioner's expert, through cross-examination established that Freon as the cooling agent would have a dramatic impact, and on a person with a diabetic condition and circulatory problems would have a more dramatic impact. In addition, I think it's significant that the label didn't simply say, or did not say, don't use inverted. It said you can use this in an inverted position. Upright or inverted is okay. And in fact, the marketing director from Burroughs testified we made a change of that label in part because we recognized that excess Freon came out when you inverted the can.
And that's where I have the problem. Where you keep saying excess, is there any evidence that it was excessive to the point that would cause or foreseeably cause the kind of injury that the plaintiff sustained?
Yes, Your Honor.
On the specific question of foreseeability on negligence and duty to warn, the failure to warn. Where is that evidence?
The evidence that I believe directly supports that is Dr. Ratner, the diabetic expert, who testified that yes, this type of over-the-counter product, he agreed, would be utilized by diabetics, and that they could foresee that diabetics could purchase this product to do exactly what Mrs. Cry did, which was to spray it on an ulcer on her foot, and it was foreseeable that they would utilize this product with the Freon in it. That, coupled with the problem with the label which allowed the excess Freon, is sufficient evidence in this case to support that causal connection between Mrs. Cry's use of the Freon with the mislabeled can and her immediate onset of a thermal injury.
Where's the evidence that it's foreseeable that the Freon would cause a frostbite injury?
Your Honor, I believe that Dr. Ratner's testimony that a drug company would know that diabetics with circulatory problems might purchase this product is some evidence that it's foreseeable a person with circulatory problems will purchase this, use it, and suffer an injury. It's also interesting that this label was only on the market for approximately 3 months. Now, the product was not pulled back. Of course, I faced the problem that respondents able to argue, you're the only one that's ever reported this incident. Well, the label was changed. People didn't use the improperly labeled can after a period of time. Unfortunately, we fell into the situation where the label had been changed, but the product had not been withdrawn from the marketplace, so Mrs. Cry was able to purchase an improperly labeled product.
Your position is, but for that change in the labeling, no telling how many people would diabetics would have been injured by this.
I think it's still an unusual condition, but it's a foreseeable condition that people with circulatory products who will use this product might suffer this type of injury.
You say unusual, once in millions of uses.
It's the fact that this product goes market for people who very well might be in Mrs. Cry's situation excludes the multiple uses of the tons of Freon, which respondent refers to in his brief, which involves the use of Freon in automobile air conditioners, cooling units, refrigerators, which obviously that's not going to create a problem for a diabetic who's looking at an over-the-counter product to treat an ulcer.
Was there anything about the Fuentes experiment that required a civil engineer to do it?
No, Your Honor, and let me talk briefly about Dr. Fuentes' experiment. Perhaps the most important point I can make is that the purpose of this experiment was extremely limited. And Dr. Fuentes' testimony and the report itself, which I understand this court now has before it, which the Court of Appeals did not have before it, specifically limits the scope of this experiment. And Dr. Fuentes says, we're not doing this experiment to make extrapolations to human feet. We're simply comparing various products to see if there's a difference in the amount of temperature reduction.
What's the relevance of that?
Your Honor, on our manufacturing defect, one of the requirements of the Civil Practice Remedies Code is that we show that there are similar products or alternative safer designs. It is significant that polysporin causes a dramatic decrease in skin temperature, where other similar medicinal products, Vactine, Quickspor, the other products that were tested, don't cause that type of dramatic decrease. And the report was specifically limited in scope. In fact, petitioner's counsel at trial, when the report was admitted into evidence, requested and was given in front of the jury a limiting instruction saying that they could only consider Dr. Clinton's report on the temperature reduction comparison between the products. It was not necessary to establish causation. They had the medical records for that and the history of use of the product. That goes to the harmless error, if it was indeed error, because this case did not turn on Dr. Fuentes' report.
But virtually anybody could have done that experiment.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because we could get a thermometer and spray it and watch it go down. In fact, the protocol as outlined by Dr. Fuentes was much more reliable than that. That thermocouplers linked to a computer printout. They repeated the experiment and procedures a number of times with the different products, and had computer readouts on exactly what the temperature reduction were.
So your position is that it was important that it be done by a civil engineer?
I think his expertise under Rule 702 in establishing a reliable protocol was important so that we could reach these conclusions. The concept itself is very simple. Which of these sprays produces the most dramatic temperature reduction?
But you said it cannot be extrapolated to human skin, is that correct?
And Dr. Fuentes testified to that.
So what's the relevance of that report if you cannot extrapolate the cooling effect to human skin? What's the relevance of the report?
Because under our marketing defect theory, we still had to demonstrate that there are design defects, alternative safer designs, and there are. There are products that do the same thing, that treat diabetic ulcers, that are sold over the counter, that don't cause this dramatic temperature reduction.
But if your position is, but your position really is not a dramatic temperature reduction. Your position is that it does cause a temperature reduction, and because diabetics are sensitive to temperature reduction, and because the doctors say what she had was a temperature reduction injury, that's the case. So so it, to you it would be immaterial that there was a dramatic temperature reduction because you don't reach that question, as I understand your position. It causes temperature reduction. She had diabetes. The doctor said what she had was a temperature reduction injury. Therefore, polysporin caused it. And the because we had a label that should have said hold the can upright, instead of saying you can hold the can upside down, which produces an excess of this coolant, we've established the foreseeability issue.
I believe that's true, and it's not necessary to have the dramatic temperature reduction, although that was what the experiment showed. But still, that experiment is totally separate and related to the design defect issue. The marketing defect, the breach of warranty, which were also found by the jury, is supported by totally independent causal evidence based primarily on the treating physicians, not just Dr. Blesius, but the other doctors who saw Mrs. Crogger in her 48-day stay at the hospital.
Did Burroughs have any evidence that this comparison was incorrect?
No, Your Honor. In fact, this is an unusual fact, but this product was never tested in any way before it was marketed. And there is significant cross-examination on FDA approval of over-the-counter products and how effective that is given the circumstances of this case. But this test result has never been put in issue by Burroughs. They've never performed a temperature reduction test on this Freon propellant product.
There was no evidence at trial that their scientists can show that it did not spray more propellant.
None at all. In fact, the evidence from the marketing person at Burroughs was that inverting the can did spray more propellant. In addition, Dr. Ratner, who was the expert called by petitioner, although he had disputes about Dr. Fuentes' experiment, did confirm in his testimony that it did measure temperature reduction. And there was no controverting evidence, no testing performed by Burroughs to show that Dr. Fuentes' report was in fact inaccurate. And there still is. The only test that Burroughs has ever performed on this product was performed 2 years after Mrs. Cry purchased it and after her injury, and involved convicts in North Carolina having their arms scratched and being sprayed with the spray to see if it caused irritation. That's the only testing this product's ever undergone.
Did it ever reach freezing temperature in Dr. Fuentes' study?
Your Honor, it did at a drop of 77 degrees. However, it's important and significant that Dr. Ratner, petitioner's expert in knowledge, he can have thermal injury without freezing temperatures. And although frostbite was used by the doctor in this condition, it is in fact a thermal injury which may have occurred without ever reaching freezing temperature.
So I'm unclear. Was the patient's foot frozen here or not?
Your Honor, we do not know if Mrs. Cry's skin ever got below 32 degrees. We do know that she used the product with an improper instruction. She had an immediate onset of a unique type of injury, which was diagnosed as a thermal injury by the doctors that saw her.
So you're conceding there is no evidence that her foot was frozen, only that there was evidence of a thermal injury, short
yes,
of freezing?
I would concede that, Your Honor, because unless we were able to actually measure what happened to Mrs. Cry the night she used, there would be no evidence. But, Your Honor, we can never recreate and reenact that exact circumstance. And that's part of our argument against petitioner's position in this case. This was not a reenactment. And petitioner cited a number of reenactment or reconstruction cases for substantial similarity. We're looking at one tiny factor on the design defect issue in this case.
Could you address, before your time runs out, the court also granted writ on point of error 11, the so-called El Paso rule, whereby appellate court declines to conduct a factual sufficiency review of mental anguish damages. Can you explain why that does not, as your adversaries contend, deny them due process?
Your Honor, there are two circumstances which in this particular case negate the responsibility of the Court of Appeals to have that standard review. I do agree that they should review that given different circumstances, but there are two circumstances in this case which don't require them to do that. Number one is the missing record. I stand before this court with a different record that was presented to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals was operating under a presumption that the record was not brought forth by petitioners supporting the judgment regardless of what standard is applied to mental anguish damages. You could have the most stringent standard in the world. The Court of Appeals didn't have a complete record. They must presume under our rules that that supports the judgment. Petitioner chose not to have a limited appeal. They had the responsibility to bring a complete record before the Court of Appeals. Secondly, the specific charge in this case on the damages issue was submitted globally. There were elements of damage, pain and suffering, mental anguish, physical impairment, medical expenses, which were in the body of the question. But the submission of the damages issue was a single damages question and answer. In this case, if there is some evidence to support each of the elements, then it's not necessary for the Court of Appeals to review the mental anguish or the physical impairment or the medical expenses damages. If there's some evidence, that global submission is supported. Petitioner has not brought that as a point of error in this case, but somehow the charge was improperly given. If the issues have been delineated with a separate damages finding for each element, I believe the Court of Appeals in El Paso, and although it's called the El Paso Rules, other courts do it as well, I believe you should, under the Constitution, review the sufficiency of the evidence and state this is the evidence that supports that. Now, in this particular case, we believe there is sufficient evidence given the hospitalization, Mrs. Cry's impairment for 2 years up until her death following this accident, to support the judgment.
You said earlier that this court had held that the mere history of use of a product could be sufficient evidence of causal connection. And the only case I see in your brief cited for that is Morgan versus CompuGraphic, which was a case, in fact, where we said there was not sufficient causal connection. Do you have any other cases where we have,
Your Honor,
we have upheld a finding of causation based on the history of the plaintiff's use?
Your Honor, I don't believe I have any cases where that is the sole evidentiary factor. The court and the courts of appeals have recognized that that may be a relevant factor coupled with others. And that's not our sole factor in this case. It's an important factor because Mrs. Cry and Mr. Cry testified as well. We're familiar with the types of problems that arose from her diabetic condition. And her testimony from deposition and Mr. Cry's deposition, testimony trial confirmed this was unique. That history perhaps alone would be insufficient on a no evidence point, but coupled with the medical opinions of the doctors to treat her, we believe that those coupled together is sufficient evidence in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the Court. The reason diabetics are more susceptible to thermal injury, as Dr. Ratner testified, is because they lose sensation in their limbs, and so there's a risk of overspraying this stuff on there because you don't feel the coldness. Of course, Ms. Cry testified that she followed the directions on the can, which was to keep the can 8 inches away and use 1 second intermittent sprays. The only testimony about getting thermal injury, whether you call it a frostbite or a thermal injury, is one of two ways. Trench foot, which has long periods of the foot being confined in a wet area so that an above freezing temperature, I believe Dr. Ratner used 40 degrees, can cause the situation, or sub-zero temperatures. The testimony in this case is uncontroverted. This is not a trench foot type case. So we are left with the question of how does this product get the temperature down below 32 degrees to cause frostbite, because that's what the medical testimony in this case is, that you have to have sub-zero temperature to get frostbite. And what explains why we have frostbite here in El Paso in this case when we've had 4 million cans of this product on the market using the same propellant that is produced in the aggregate 4 million tons every year? Why does it cause frostbite here and nowhere else? And it would seem to me that if you were going to put on the case, you would have to have some pretty compelling evidence, and there simply is no compelling evidence in this case, either of the causation or that this manufacturer should have been aware of this particular type of risk. It's disingenuous to say that there was no testing of this product. This product is identical in terms of its thermal qualities as Neosporin, which has been on the market since the 1960s. And that product was extensively tested, both by Burroughs and the FDA. It was applied directly to a live rabbit's eye. It was applied to burnt skin. It was applied to skin grafts. The same types of conditions which one would think would show the existence of thermal injuries, if indeed there are thermal injuries.
Was it a different propellant using that product?
No. Neosporin, Polysporin initially all used CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. When the FCC, we decided that we didn't want to use CFCs, then all the manufacturers have moved to a hydrocarbon product. And that, in fact, was used in the study that respondent refers to that was kept out of evidence, the one on the baby umbilical cord, because that was using a hydrocarbon, which was a different
question. Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first clause. We will take a brief recess.